but kept his hands on Charlotte's arms until she was standing independently.
"Charlotte Wyndham, explain yourself," Her Grace snapped. "And you, Mr. Sherborne, taking unseemly liberties under the guise of paying a social call. Is this how you repay my welcome?"
Uncle Percival stood at Aunt's elbow, a portrait of the outraged patriarch.
"Sir, you will step away from my niece."
"Uncle, Aunt, please calm yourselves. Mr. Sherborne was about to leave, and I—"
Two people whom Charlotte loved very much were regarding her with heart-rending dismay. If she explained that she'd just refused Mr. Sherborne's proposal, then kissed him as if he were her every wish come true, they'd be hurt and angry past all bearing.
"Mr. Sherborne," said the man himself, "was about to ask a servant where to find you, sir, for Miss Charlotte has done me the great honour of indicating that she'd welcome my addresses, were I to gain your permission to court her."
Charlotte's heart thumped against her ribs, as if she stood on a high precipice, and couldn't make herself step back.
"You'd like to court our Charlotte?" Her Grace asked.
"Oh, Aunt, no."
"I'd like to start by courting Miss Charlotte." "Charlotte?" Uncle Percival asked. "I cannot believe the tableau that greeted us. If you are in any way coerced, then courtship, much less marriage, is out of the question, and Mr. Sherborne will return to Wales permanently."
Mr. Sherborne was watching her, waiting for her to see him effectively banished from England through no fault of his own. She couldn't do that, couldn't make him pay for her lack of caution. Of all women, she refused to see an innocent party ruined simply because she'd stolen one more kiss.
"I was in no way coerced, Uncle. I apologize for upsetting you and Aunt. I am very fond of Mr. Sherborne, though that is no excuse for how I've behaved."
"The fault is mine," Mr. Sherborne said, with a credible rendition of bashful chagrin. "I apologize to your graces as well."
Aunt Esther reached for Uncle Percival's hand, suggesting that Charlotte had rattled a woman who thought nothing of scolding King George himself. Uncle Percival tucked her hand over his arm and rested his palm over her fingers.
"Apologies accepted," he said. "Don't let it happen again. Mr. Sherborne, you will spare me a few minutes in the garden when you've bade my niece a proper farewell?"
"Yes, sir."
"Leave this door open," Aunt Esther said. "For the sake of my nerves and Mr. Sherborne's continued good health, you will leave this door open."
They left, and Charlotte took a seat on a chair by the hearth, rather than on the sofa where she'd—
"Did you mean it?" Mr. Sherborne asked. "I'll not have it said you were forced, Charlotte. You either tell your family you were having a small adventure with a willing bachelor, or you become Mrs. Lucas Sherborne. Don't lead me around Mayfair by the nose, only to reject me several weeks hence."
"My family would be disappointed in me for that small adventure."
"Then they would ruin Lucas Sherborne without even trying. The invitations would disappear. The greetings would become perfunctory. Civilities would be withheld. A man who'd done nothing wrong would make a hasty departure for Wales, like a chambermaid who'd been turned off without a character for refusing the lord of the manor's advances. Sherborne's disgrace would be Charlotte's fault."
"Make up your mind," Mr. Sherborne said, "and know that if we marry, I will be a husband to you in every way that matters. Ours won't be a match based on affection, but neither will it be a union of appearances. Choose carefully, Charlotte, and I will honour your decision."
Chapter 5 Sherborne could honour Charlotte Wyndham's decision, but could he honour her? This question plagued him, even as he knocked on the Earl of Westhaven's door 2 days after becoming an engaged man. Charlotte had kissed him, like every bachelor's naughty dream, then flung his proposal—well, not flung it in his face, but handed it back to him, like a wrinkled, damp handkerchief. He had no title, no illustrious family history, no impressive coat of arms, no family motto beyond "Make money and sneer at the titled fools." Of course she'd refused him. He'd been a fool to expect otherwise. Only when she'd stood to lose her family's respect had she agreed to become Mrs. Lucas Sherborne. Sherborne lacked aristocratic antecedents, but he had pride, and thus he'd insisted on negotiating the settlements with the Earl of Westhaven in person. His lordship was the ducal heir, and apparently the financial brains of the Wyndham family.
"Mr. Sherborne, welcome," said a liveried butler. "His lordship awaits you in his study."
Sherborne passed over his hat and walking stick, and followed the butler down a corridor that boasted not one cobweb, not one speck of dust or smudged mirror. Those mirrors had been placed to catch and reflect sunlight, giving the house an airy, pleasant quality, at variance with the priggish butler.
"Mr. Lucas Sherborne to see you, my lord."
The butler presented Sherborne's card on a silver tray. Westhaven bore a resemblance to both of his parents. He had Morland's height, the ducal nose, and lean build, and the Duchess's green eyes and chin. His hair was chestnut, and he exuded about as much hospitality as an elderly cat, welcoming an invasion of noisy children into the library.
"Sherborne, good day."
A lordly perusal followed. Sherborne had endured many such inspections, and he perused Westhaven right back.
"You had a reputation for brawling at school,"
Westhaven said, after the butler had withdrawn.
"Aunt Arabella says you were cheerfully dedicated to the ruin of a neighbour of long standing, which neighbour is married to my cousin, and now you demand that the settlements be negotiated in person, rather than through the good offices of the diplomatic intermediaries whose job it is to tend to these matters. Don't expect many concessions, Sherborne."
Sherborne took a moment to look over the Earl's study. The desk was tidy to the point of obsessive organization. From the gleaming silver pen tray to the immaculate blotter, to the sealed correspondence sitting in a neat stack in another silver tray.
"Cheerfully dedicated to the ruin of a neighbor," Sherborne replied. "Interesting, and here I thought I'd cheerfully awaited repayment of debts, decades overdue. May I remind your lordship that Haverford and I have made our peace? Perhaps you and I should change the subject. Discussing another man's finances strikes me as ill-bred."
Now came the lordly reassessment, from which Westhaven meant a twitch of the ducal proboscis and a narrowing of green eyes.
"Quite. Please, have a seat."
As a former schoolyard brawler, Sherborne took that seat at one end of the sofa, rather than perch before the altar of Westhaven's desk like a supplicant. With the toe of a boot, Sherborne flipped up a fringe of the carpet as he sat.
"Charlotte is dear to us,"
Westhaven said, taking a wing chair.
"We will expect a generous contribution to her settlement, and I have a very specific figure in mind for her pin money."
Delightful. The royal we had a Wyndham counterpart.
"Charlotte is dear to me as well," Sherborne said, "and as pleased as I am to pass the time of day with you, I'd rather spend my afternoon with her. Perhaps you'd share that specific figure before sunset."
A footman interrupted, bearing a fortune in silver on a tea tray. The next 5 minutes were spent testing Sherborne's manners, though in fairness to Westhaven the cakes were excellent and the tea strong. Some hosts served Sherborne the day-old cakes and the used tea-leaves, as if he'd not know a stale sweet when he bit into it. Westhaven set about an interrogation that was doomed to brevity. Sherborne's family consisted of one crotchety great-uncle on the maternal side. His residential real estate was one modest dwelling of 20 bedrooms, the former dower house to Haverford Castle. He did not wager on cards, or horses, or make stupid bets on the book at White's.
"You would have me believe you are a dull fellow,"
Westhaven said.
"I cannot credit that Charlotte Wyndham would yoke herself to a judge."
"To an untitled judge."
"We drudges tend to redeem ourselves in important regards. I will keep the lady in comfort and style, for example, and I won't insult her with a string of mistresses whom I flaunt at the theatre before her friends. I will never break my neck, riding to hounds, half drunk out of sheer boredom. I won't gamble away her pin money merely to impress the fellows. I don't trifle with the help. Might we discuss figures, my lord?
Charlotte is forthright,
Westhaven said.
One shudders to think what sort of children the two of you will raise.
Sherborne set his teacup beside the tray, not on it.
We will raise well-loved children if the heavenly powers grant us offspring, and we will raise them. They won't be packed off to public school from infancy for the ritual starvation and torture that passes for aristocratic education. Nor will they be banished to the fourth floor until the age of six, at which time they'll be permitted to parade through the parlour twice a week, spouting Latin and sums.
Westhaven set Sherborne's teacup on the tray.
The parade was nigh daily, if you must know, and started when I was four. My father was a military man, and in some ways always will be.
Hence the immaculate desk, the pens laid neatly in the tray, and the compulsion to subject all new recruits to parade inspection.
I brought a set of figures, Sherborne said. I'd like to discuss them with you.
The door burst open, and a small boy cantered. He did not run, he cantered across the carpet.
Tally-ho! Tally-ho! Reynard is making for his covert!
The boy came to a halt, confusion in eyes, the same shade of green as Westhaven's.
Excuse me, Papa, I thought you met Uncle Valentine for lunch on Mondays.
Uncle Valentine is working on the final movement of a new sonata,
Westhaven said, gathering the boy into his lap.
You know how he is about finales.
The child was utterly at home, roosting on his papa's knees.
He's awful. Aunt Ellen says so, then she kisses him. We have company.
We do. This is Mr. Sherborne. He's a friend of Cousin Charlotte's, a good friend.
Well, no, he wasn't. He was her fiancé.
Greetings, young sir.
I'm a viscount, but not the real kind, the child said. Cousin Charlotte doesn't like to climb trees, but she can do sums in her head even better than Papa. Her favourite cake's a lemon, which is capital, because I don't care for lemon.
Sherborne would have bet his walking stick, if he were to bet anything, that Charlotte had no particular fondness for lemon cakes, though for this nephew she'd have told that lie.
I hear something, Westhaven said, cocking his head. Do you hear it?
The boy scrambled off his father's lap.
Is it a fox? Do you hear the wily Reynard, making designs upon our biddies? Foul dastard! You shall not menace our biddies! Tally-ho! Pericles, tally-ho!
Westhaven rose to close the door behind the first flight, pausing to smooth the carpet fringe Sherborne had slipped.
His brother prefers shooting expeditions in the garden. God help the pigeons if the boy ever learns to aim his slingshot.
Foul dastard? That was not a small boy's oath.
Westhaven, have you been riding to hounds in the parlour?
His lordship resumed his chair, crossing one ankle over the opposite knee.
When my wife goes calling, I sometimes take it upon myself to entertain the children. About those figures.
Sherborne extracted a sheaf of papers from his breast pocket and passed them over. Westhaven drank another cup of tea while he studied the proposed settlements.
Can you afford this, Sherborne?
The question was merely curious, which was all that saved Westhaven from wearing tea on his tidily knotted cravat.
My cash reserves are not where I'd wish them to be, Sherborne said, though most would envy me my solvency. I've lately taken on a charitable project of considerable proportions, invested in a new mining venture, and otherwise committed liquid assets. I never involve the resources of my bank in personal obligations, nor do I allow the other directors or owners to do so.
That charitable project would be Cousin Elizabeth's lending libraries,
Westhaven said.
I've heard something about them.
Part of making peace with the Duke next door had been indulging the Duchess of Haverford's passion for lending libraries. Sherborne had purchased a fortune in books from His Grace, and in essence forgiven the rest of Haverford's indebtedness. The decision had seemed prudent at the time, though Sherborne dreaded his meetings with the Duchess. She was so very enthusiastic about her causes, and about her damned Duke.
The short answer is that I can afford the settlements proposed. If I acquire a sleeping partner or two for my mining venture, I'll have more latitude, but those figures are within my means. If there's one asset I bring to this union, it's the ability to assure Charlotte of a comfortable dotage.
She'll have a comfortable dotage with or without you, Sherborne. The Wyndhams take care of their own.
Gone was the doting master of foxhounds, and in his place sat the prosy ducal heir.
Review the figures, your lordship. I'm prepared to negotiate within limits. But you will please assure me that Charlotte's funds will be managed by you, or one of your brothers, not by some paunchy solicitor whose attachment is to Charlotte's coin rather than her welfare.
Westhaven popped a tea-cake into his mouth, the whole thing at once.
I will manage the funds personally, or, in conjunction with my sister, the Countess of Hazleton. Her ladyship's skill with investments goes beyond genius. She will like you, though her version of liking can leave a fellow feeling as if he's been mauled by a lioness. One makes allowances. She's married to Hazleton, after all.
Sherborne resigned himself to further study of the Wyndham family tree. No other lord of his acquaintance would liken his sister's approval to an attack by a wild creature, and yet Westhaven conveyed genuine affection for the lady.
"I'll await your response to my proposal," Sherborne said, rising. "My thanks for the hospitality. I have one question for you."
"Ask."
Westhaven wrapped two tea-cakes in a table napkin and slipped them into his pocket, then got to his feet.
"Do you hoard food?"
"Of course not. Those are for the hunt breakfast."
Westhaven loved his son, which reassured Sherborne, as signed settlement agreements would not have.
"Who is Charlotte's best friend?"
Westhaven paused with his hand on the door-latch.
"Her best friend now? She was thick as thieves with the porter girl, but that was years ago. The poor thing left town amid some talk, and I gather Charlotte has kept mostly to the company of her sisters since then. Why do you ask?"
"I'd thought to make the acquaintance of Charlotte's friends, to learn what he could from them about a woman he was likely to spend the rest of his life with."
"Ah, now, there I can offer you a bit of marital advice,"
Westhaven said, with more enthusiasm than the topic warranted.
"You be Charlotte's friend, and allow her to be yours. The other party is lovely, of course. Connubial bliss is more than a cliché. But be Charlotte's friend."
The aristocracy was prone to eccentricity. Foxes under the sofa, for example.
"I'll be her husband, once you approve those settlements. Good day, my lord."
Sherborne left the Earl's townhouse with much to ponder. Westhaven was a lordly prig, a ferociously devoted father, a loyal brother and cousin, and a conscientious minder of the family fortunes. Also besotted with his countess, if gossip was to be believed. Sherborne was not besotted with Charlotte Wyndham, but one admission she'd made gave him peace where their union was concerned. "If I were to marry anybody, it would be you." If Charlotte was honest, and Sherborne believed she was, then her objection was not to him personally, but to marriage in general. He wasn't overly fond of the institution himself, which boded well for their expectations of each other, if not for their connubial bliss.
"The only possible risk is that he might from time to time be somewhat cash-poor,"
Maggie, Countess of Hazleton, said. "The same ailment afflicts half the titled families in the realm."
"Sherborne is poor?"
Charlotte couldn't keep the dismay from her tone.
"Far from it," Maggie replied, taking off a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles. "We would never allow you to entertain his suit if he were without means. Sherborne's worth is impressive. He owns majority shares in a bank, shipping ventures, and numerous mercantile establishments. He owns an entire school in the Midlands and built a hotel last year in the Lakes that was booked to capacity all summer."
"May I see the figures?"
Westhaven had given Charlotte a summary version of the negotiations. Sherborne had met, or exceeded, every item on the Westhaven's list, unasked. His lordship hadn't seen fit to explain to Charlotte what the list of demands had entailed. If Sherborne had been negotiating settlements on behalf of a cousin, he would have ensured that she grasped every detail down to the penny.
"Charlotte, I understand that you're nervous," Maggie said, pouring herself a third cup of tea. "But you needn't fret about the settlements. Sherborne assured Westhaven that every aspect of his proposal was within his means."
"You have doubts?" Charlotte certainly had doubts, an entire queasy tummyful. She'd sent Tansy to the post with next month's payments for the various Mrs. Wesleys, but Tansy wasn't coming to Wales. Charlotte would need to establish alternate arrangements almost as soon as she arrived at Sherborne Hall.
"I have reservations," Maggie said, "but then I've become averse to risk since the boys came along."
The boys were at present with their papa in the park, flying kites, sailing boats on the Serpentine, and otherwise enjoying a pretty autumn day. Would Sherborne take time for outings with his children? And good gracious, Charlotte blushed to think of how those children would be conceived. Sharing passionate kisses was all well and good, also safe. Never had a child resulted from intemperate kisses alone. This marriage would involve far more than kisses, though. Sherborne had made that clear.
"I need pin money, Maggie. Lots and lots of pin money."
Her ladyship was a formidable redhead, nearly 6 inches taller than Charlotte. The Countess had a regal air, despite having been born on the wrong side of the ducal blanket.
"The sums proposed aren't generous to a fault, Charlotte. Why do you need more?"
"I just do. Sherborne has never had a wife before, and he can't very well waltz into his club and ask the nearest viscount how much a well-born missus costs these days. He won't know enough to quibble over the figure for pin money."
Pin money was Charlotte's to use as she alone saw fit. Even Sherborne had defined it thus. And yet, deceiving him made her uneasy. Telling him the truth regarding the various Mrs. Wesleys was impossible. Not yet. Not before the wedding, and possibly not after. Maggie lifted the pot, as if to refill Charlotte's cup, but Charlotte hadn't taken more than a polite sip. Her ladyship set down the teapot and gave Charlotte an uncomfortably protracted perusal.
"Charlotte, you were seen by their graces in a most passionate embrace with your prospective spouse. If you don't care for him, say so now."
That interrupted farewell kiss had not been the most passionate Charlotte had shared with Sherborne.
"I respect the gentleman greatly, but hardly know what to expect from marriage to him."
After Charlotte's initial refusal of his suit, how could their wedding night be anything but awkward?
"He was compelled by honour to propose to me, and that is not the best foundation for a successful marriage."
"Would you like a crumpet?"
"No, thank you."
Did polite society have nothing better to do than swill tea and consume sweets?
"If honour compelled him to propose, what compelled you to accept?"
The same inconvenient honour.
"I was tired of turning down buffoons. Mr. Sherborne is a surpassingly sensible man, and he doesn't put on airs."
"You're saying he suits you?"
Charlotte wanted to bolt away from the conversation, but Maggie was family, and as the oldest female cousin, she'd always been something of a confidant.
"I hope he suits me. I still need more pin money."
"Then we'll reduce his contribution to your dower account."
He had offered settlements at the limit of what Maggie considered prudent. Why?
"Reduce them by as much as you can, without insulting him. I have no wish to beggar my husband."
"You won't," Maggie said, munching on a crumpet. "He's merely in the same position as most of the best families, though his wealth is tied up in commercial assets rather than land. He has a substantial income, and he's reinvesting much of it in his mining venture. New businesses typically require capital and attention before they become profitable. He also refuses to treat his bank as his personal treasure trove, which is commendable."
Maggie reviewed with Charlotte the terms of the proposed agreement, paragraph by paragraph. But Charlotte couldn't focus. The numbers stuck with her, of course, but the endless convoluted words.
"You're wool-gathering," Maggie said some 30 minutes later. "With a wedding in less than a week, you're entitled."
By special license, of course. The stated reason was to allow the ceremony to take place at the Moorland townhouse. but the real reason was Her Grace's nerves.
"I'm preoccupied,"
Charlotte said, the grandmamma of all understatements, surely.
"I wish I knew what to expect. Mr. Sherborne and I aren't that well acquainted. I know hardly anything about him."
Maggie patted her hand.
"Marriage is an adventure for two. Look for the good in him, the same as you would with any friend. Give him your loyalty and the benefit of the doubt. Find things to laugh about together, and don't worry if the early days are a bit bumpy. That's part of it."
What about the wedding night? What about those moments under the covers when the two became as one flesh?
"Maggie, the whole business makes me anxious."
Panicked, in truth. Charlotte was about to take vows with a man who believed she didn't respect him, and who very possibly didn't respect her. How in all creation was she to get through the wedding night?
"If you're anxious, that's good. Marriage is an enormous step. One shouldn't take it lightly."
Maggie left off studying the garden.
"They're back," she said, rising and gathering her skirts. "I can hear them coming up the alley. We must greet them and hear all about their adventures."
Charlotte rose slowly, keeping a hand on the back of her chair.
"You'll see the settlements modified. More pin money, less invested in the funds." "Of course, though I think you're daft. You're also a bit pale, but then this has been an exciting week. Come along, my dear, and prepare to be regaled with tales of dragons and wizards."
Charlotte followed Maggie back into the house, more relieved than she could say. The wedding night was still a looming ordeal, but at least she'd weathered tea on her ladyship's third-floor balcony without serious embarrassment.
"We found Cousin Charlotte's friend in the park," the Earl of Hazleton said, "much to the delight of all concerned."
Hazleton, a dark-haired brute with northern antecedents in his speech, was being ironic.
"Charlotte, good day," Sherborne said,
as Hazleton, in broad daylight, and with minor children looking on, kissed his countess on the cheek.
"Won't you introduce us?"
In the park, Hazleton hadn't stood on ceremony. With a toddler grasped by the hand and a very small child clinging to his back, he'd marched right up to Sherborne and demanded to make the acquaintance of Cousin Charlotte's friend. Charlotte looked pale and pretty in a sprigged muslin walking dress that was several years out of date, judging by the waistline. She recited the introductions with a haste that verged on uncordial.
"May I walk you home?" Sherborne asked. "I'm sure Hazleton can see to my horse."
"I'd be happy to," Hazleton said, slipping an arm around his countess's waist for pity's sake.
"We'll wish you good day, then," Sherborne offered Charlotte his arm.
She hadn't consented to his escort, but her pallor, her quiet, and the way she retied her bonnet ribbons twice suggested she might welcome a respite from all this marital affection. Nonetheless, much cheek-kissing and hugging was required before two women who'd probably seen each other every week for the past 14 years could part. They'd see each other again in a few days, though Charlotte had agreed to leave for Wales immediately after the wedding breakfast.
"Did your cousin terrify you with lurid tales of the wedding night?" Sherborne asked as he and his intended started down the alley.
She dodged discussion of wedding nights in any sense.
Which meant Charlotte had, indeed, raised the topic.
"This bothers you."
Was that why Charlotte was pale?
"We needn't consummate the marriage until we're home in Wales, if you prefer."
The words were out, spoken by some idiot with pretensions to gentlemanly consideration, or cowardice.
"We're putting the business off. Make it any easier?"
"The business."
She referred to consummation of solemn vows, the first joining of man and wife, as the business.
"Delaying the wedding night will allow for the occasion to be more private. I don't fancy making my debut as your lover at some noisy coaching inn."
Charlotte's pace slowed as they approached the street.
"You don't?"
He did, he did, he most certainly did. The travelling coach was another possibility, and quite comfortable.
"One wants to make a good first impression."
Her smile was hesitant.
"Are you nervous, Mr. Sherborne?"
He was attracted to her, but on another level he was uneasy. Charlotte had chosen him over scandal, making them reluctant partners at best, a marriage not of cordial convenience, but of pure expedience.
We will have decades of married life to share a bed. Why hurry into the situation when we could instead choose the moment that best pleases us both?
The situation? The ailment of vocabulary Charlotte suffered was apparently contagious. Charlotte lowered her voice, despite the racket provided by the nearby street. Part of me wants to get the consummation over with. And part of her dreaded the occasion. Splendid. They walked along, two people bound for marriage, and possibly for perdition.
Did your cousin review the settlements with you?
In detail. I'm asking for more pin money, but less in the funds. Nothing would do, but Maggie must have this discussion with me on her favourite third-floor balcony.
Why more pin money? And what did a third-floor balcony have to do with...
Sherborne's bedroom was on the third floor of his manor house, and had a lovely balcony. This did not bode well for the wedding night, even in Wales. The rest of their walk home was made without conversation. Apparently Charlotte's pallor resulted from tea on a third-floor balcony, not worry over the wedding night. Though she was worried, and thus Sherborne was worried, ye gods, marriage was making him daft before he'd even spoken his vows. That Charlotte's cousin hadn't respected her fear of heights was disquieting, but that Charlotte wanted more pin money was a problem. What could she possibly spend lavish pin money on in rural Wales? And how would he come up with yet more coin for the bride, who was marrying him only to avoid disgrace? Chapter 6
Everything Lucas Sherborne touches turns to gold.
Quinton, Earl of Brentford, was certain of this happy conclusion.
Papa-in-law disapproves of him on that basis alone. Says new money should never be trusted.
His lordship sets great store by tradition.
Meyerbeek wrapped a stack of papers in a folder and tied it with red ribbon. Brantford's man of business was large and bluff, though he took care with the papers, ribbon and bow. Lord Halstead also set great store by his daughter, whom Brantford had married a good 5 years ago, or was it 6, possibly 7, Veronica was a mousy little thing who had yet to produce a single infant. Other than that, she was an untroublesome wife who'd brought beautiful settlements to marriage, though an earl without an heir was not a man to be envied.
"Dear papa-in-law has yet to put his financial house in order,"
Brantford said, because Meyerbeek had doubtless heard the gossip, and ignoring the obvious would only fuel speculation.
When the inevitable happens, I hope to be in a position to prevent scandal from my in-laws.
Which scandal would, of course, wash up on Brantford's own shores.
Very noble of you, sir.
Meyerbeek tied up another set of papers.
You are well on your way to a handsome fortune. Nonetheless, I must echo his lordship's caution where Mr. Sherborne's new coal mine is concerned.
Meyerbeek's penchant for caution was as reliable as Veronica's appointments at the milliner's. The woman was addicted to buying hats.
"You don't trust Sherborne?"
Behind the closed doors of Brantford's private office, he could pose that question to a subordinate. In the clubs, nobody would dare be so blunt when Sherborne's bank held mortgages on a number of titled estates.
"Mr. Sherborne's integrity as a businessman is above reproach, from what I've gathered. He doesn't engage in sharp practice, doesn't go back on a contract signed and sealed. But the mining operation is different."
Mines were simple businesses. One dug a hole, excavated valuable ore, and got paid for it. Miners grumbled about low wages and the occasional mine collapsed. But England's appetite for coal was insatiable, and thus the profit was reliable.
"Different how?"
Brantford asked, keeping his seat behind his desk.
"The Duke of Haverford is Sherborne's neighbour, and soon to be connected to him by marriage. Haverford is only supporting this mine because Sherborne has promised to run it as an example of the most enlightened business practices. The workers are to have decent housing. No children will be employed below the surface, that sort of thing. Very forward-thinking, if you take my meaning.
Progress was good, and usually went hand in hand with profit. Forward-thinking could be troublesome.
All the more reason, Brantford said, that Sherborne should ally himself with somebody who can be the voice of wisdom in the face of Haverford's fanciful notions. His Grace is a fine fellow, but like my papa-in-law, he clings to land rents, flocks, and herds as the only acceptable sources of income.
Those aspects of our economy remain vitally important.
Meyerbeek tapped his hat onto his head.
Might I suggest, if you do invest in Mr. Sherborne's mine, that you pay a call on your business partner in Wales and inspect the works yourself. Haverford lives in the immediate area, and would take your involvement more seriously if you showed the flag, as it were.
Wales had decent shooting, and Veronica didn't exactly need her husband underfoot during the little season.
I'll consider it. My thanks, as always, for your efforts, Meyerbeek.
Meyerbeek went on his way, folders tucked in a plain black leather satchel. Brantford waited a suitable interval. One did not perambulate about Mayfair with one's man of business, then timed his own departure, so he'd be only a few minutes late for his appointment with Sherborne. Sherborne's butler was all anybody could wish for in an upper servant, and the townhouse was appointed in elegant, if slightly overstated, good taste. Brantford's host greeted him in a room that might have been any lord's estate office, ancestors scowling down from portraits on the walls, carpets thick and recently swept, but for the plethora of correspondence in four different trays on the desk.
"You are a busy man."
The letters Brantford could see all bore a recent date. Sherborne was also, apparently, a man who didn't let his affairs go untended for long.
"I said as much," Sherborne replied. "Please, have a seat."
A seat facing the desk was a novel perspective, putting Brantford uncomfortably in mind of frequent interviews with his papa when deportment at university had been disappointing. Sherborne likely knew this. He didn't know enough to ring for tea, though, which was a shame when the man could maunder on at such tiresome length about a damned coal mine.
"You have a solid grasp of the venture you're undertaking," Brantford said, "and the terms you propose for my role are agreeable in principle. When can you reduce them to writing?"
Sherborne opened a drawer, produced a sheaf of papers, and passed them across the desk.
"You'll find four copies, two for you and two for me. I've signed them all. My staff can witness your signature if you're inclined to invest."
A conundrum presented itself. Sherborne's quaint insistence on doing business face-to-face had proved useful. Brantford liked knowing that he wasn't engaging in commerce with some vulgar cit, liked knowing exactly where Sherborne would dwell when in town. He liked seeing proof that Sherborne was industrious and conscientious about his affairs. For Sherborne to insist on an appointment on his terms and on his turf was a petty stratagem, but tolerable. This notion of signing a legal document on the spot, though, not the done thing.
"I'd need time to read every word," Brantford said. "I mean no slight to you, of course, but any scribe can make a mistake or misinterpret his master's directions."
Sherborne rose and withdrew a key from a japanned box on the mantel.
"I wrote out all four copies myself. As contracts go, it's a brief and to the point."
He wound the clock on the mantel, which would typically be a butler's job. The hour approached three, and at four Brantford was expected at a cosy little household off of Cavendish Square. A gentleman kept a new mistress waiting at peril to his exchequer.
"Let's have a look," Brantford said, smoothing out a copy of the contract. "Though perhaps you'd be good enough to order us a tea tray while I read."
His objective was to get Sherborne out of the room, because a bit of judicious reconnaissance was called for. Sherborne merely tugged on a bell pull twice. Well, damn. Lucas Sherborne was no fool, an oddly cheering realization. Brantford's money would be safe in Sherborne's hands, and that was the larger concern. Besides, the terms on paper weren't exactly binding on a peer of the realm, despite what the courts might lead the common man to believe. Sherborne resumed his seat behind the desk, and took up the first of the items stacked in the nearest tray.
"You're soon to be married, I hear," Brantford said a few minutes later.
In all the world was any soporific more effective than lawyerly prose. Sherborne didn't even look up from his reading.
"Miss Charlotte Wyndham has looked with favour upon my suit."
"You can't fool me, Sherborne. You're no more smitten with your bride than I am with the prospect of Lady Deerwood's card party tonight."
Sherborne set the letter aside, shot his cuffs, and folded his hands on the blotter.
"Did you just insult my fiancée?"
"Oh, dear. The lower orders could be high sticklers. Witness the proliferation of etiquette manuals they consulted on everything from social calls to funerals."
"I insult neither you nor your lovely bride, Sherborne. I insult the institution of marriage. I have years of experience with holy matrimony that you have yet to acquire. Allow me my crotchets,
Sherborne resumed reading.
"If your experience of marriage has been disappointing, then you insult yourself, for I know a gentleman would never slander his wife."
Brantford resumed reading, mostly to hide a smile.
Sherborne was precious in his ferocious propriety and his unrelenting focus on business. The clubs were buzzing about his upcoming nuptials, wondering how and why he'd become engaged to the formidable Charlotte Wyndham.
Money had doubtless played a role. As a bachelor, Brantford had observed Miss Charlotte from the safe distance of the men's punch-bowl. She had an air of discontent, and at an archery tournament her aim was notoriously unreliable, or rather too accurate. Perhaps the Wyndhams had paid Sherborne to spirit the lady off to Wales.
"That reminds me," Brantford said, giving up in the middle of the paragraph about indemnifying and holding harmless. "I'll want to inspect the works first-hand. I'm told it's sound business to have a look oneself, rather than rely on, what is the word, toadies?"
Sherborne's smile was cool.
"You'd travel out to Wales to see the mine?"
Brantford would travel out to Wales to do some shooting, pay a call on His Grace of Haverford, and avoid several tedious weeks of card parties while Veronica bought out the milliner's shops.
"It seems prudent to have a look at where my money's going,"
Brantford said.
"This is your first mining venture, while I've seen many. I understand Haverford has tried to hamper the operation with quaint notions of lavish housing and exorbitant wages for the workers. We'll soon enlighten His Grace about how business is done."
Sherborne set a silver standish on Brantford's side of the desk.
"We will do no such thing, unless you sign those contracts now. I leave for Wales immediately after my wedding, and work on the housing at the mine started last month. We'll sink the main shaft before St. Andrew's Day."
Brantford chose a quill from the three in the standish. He wasn't about to give himself a headache, reading two more pages of heretofores and however acceptings. A difference of opinion on a business matter was settled amicably or not at all. Only fools, or those already afflicted with scandal, resorted to the courts.
"A moment," Sherborne said, as Brantford dipped the pen. "We need witnesses."
"Good God."
"As you please, Sherborne, but I draw the line at allowing you to count my teeth."
A butler and clerk appended their signatures as witnesses, then departed without a word.
"Thus do we become partners," Brantford said, extending a hand. "Shall I take my copies with me?"
Sherborne shook hands briefly.
"Your copies will be delivered when I have a bank draft from you. When we both have signed copies, and only then, I'll deposit your bank draft as described on the last page of the agreement. Until the consideration has been exchanged, we have no enforceable bargain under the law."
"You do like to belabour the details, don't you?"
Sherborne would be a terror with subcontractors and subordinates. Papa-in-law might have a much fatter purse if he'd found somebody with Sherborne's blunt sensibilities to manage his affairs.
"Applicable law is never a detail," Sherborne held the door. "I look forward to showing you the work soon. When can I expect your bank draft?"
"My business partner is a barbarian," Brantford marvelled.
as his host escorted him down the main staircase.
"One doesn't mention money directly, Sherborne. You'll have the mine producing before Christmas if you're always so fixed on your objectives."
"We're not partners yet."
Sherborne passed Brantford his hat and walking stick. But they soon would be, and Brantford had a good feeling about that. Sherborne wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty, to ask the rude questions upon which the whole transaction hinged. Mining ventures weren't for the faint of heart. Brantford avoided touring his more than once a year if he could help it, and he never went below the surface. But they could be wonderfully profitable.
"I'll have my man bring around the funds tomorrow," Brantford said.
He waited a moment for Sherborne to pontificate about the hazards of entrusting a man of business with an actual bank draft, but Mr. Sherborne only held the door open, like a footman, or one of the large fellows hired to eject unruly persons from taverns.
"Best wishes on your upcoming nuptials, Sherborne, and safe journey to Wales. May your union be both happy and fruitful."
Brantford trotted down the steps, entirely in charity with life. He was paying a call on a comely mistress. He'd just secured a significant interest in a new mine, and his business partner had a Midas touch. Brantford did wish his own union could be fruitful, though, not that he'd given up hope. As for the happy part, who needed a happy marriage when life was otherwise humming along to such a cheerful tune? Charlotte had tried counting turnpikes, posting-ins, cows, even trees. She'd read, she'd played solitary card games, she'd penned a trio of letters from a non-existent deceased husband, Mr. Wesley Cooper this time, until the rocking of the coach gave her a headache. The journey to Wales was taking forever. Sherborne left her to the joys of his travelling coach, a monstrosity of a vehicle pulled by teams of gigantic horses. The size of the conveyance meant speed was sacrificed to comfort, and the state of the King's Highway ensured comfort was a lost cause. Charlotte's constant companion was worry about the wedding night, about marriage to a man she didn't know well, about Maggie's contention that Sherborne could become financially overextended. Charlotte worried about the unknown unfortunates in London, whom she might have helped, and she resolved to continue offering aid wherever it was needed in Wales. Somehow, she'd send out her banknotes to the Mrs. Wesleys, and find a way to broach the matter with Sherborne when the time was right. Though the time might not be right for years. The route was somewhat familiar, because Charlotte had visited Wales frequently as a child, and because she'd attended a house party at Haverford Castle only a few months earlier. A cold, sleety rain began to fall as they prepared to leave the final inn before reaching their destination. That Charlotte should bring bad weather with her to her new home was appropriate, for her mood was less than sunny. The coach door opened without warning.
"Might I join you?"
Sherborne stood outside, waiting for Charlotte's permission to enter his own conveyance.
"You'll catch your death loitering in a downpour. Get in here this instant."
He climbed in, rocking the vehicle and bringing with him the scents of wet wool, horse, and leather.
"Sit with me,"
Charlotte said, when he hesitated to choose a bench.
"We'll share a lap robe."
They were married. They could share everything, in theory. At the inns, they'd taken meals together in private dining rooms, then retired to separate quarters. Sherborne had been a conscientious escort, but he'd offered little conversation and less companionship.
"Are you cold?" he asked.
Charlotte was swathed in a velvet-lined cloak, and the inn had supplied hot bricks for the coach's floor, and yet the damp had crept into her bones.
"A trifle chilly," she said. "A result of inactivity and fatigue, no doubt. Strange beds, however commodious, don't offer the best sleep."
Sherborne withdrew a wool blanket from under the opposite bench and spread it over their knees. Without warning, his arm came around Charlotte's shoulders.
"I could sleep for a week," he groused. "Every time I make the journey to London, I vow it will be my last."
"You ride for miles without tiring."
Hour after hour, he had ridden before the coach, changing horses when the coachman swapped teams.
At 20 I rode for miles without tiring. Now I merely want to be home. I've sent word ahead to your sister, though if she's on hand to welcome us, that means Haverford will be about as well.
He tugged at Charlotte's shoulder, urging her against his side. She complied, though such proximity to an adult male was novel. Also warm. You invited Elizabeth and her duke to your home. Sherborne stuffed his riding gloves into a pocket of his greatcoat and tucked the blanket more closely around Charlotte's legs.
To our home. Our wedding was small, and any fuss your family can make to excuse their absence at the ceremony ought to be encouraged.
Charlotte refused to lament the nature of her wedding. No St. George's at Hanover Square for her, no assembling all of the cousins or reading of the banns. She'd spoken her vows in the Morland formal parlour, with aunt, uncle, Westhaven and his countess, and Maggie and her earl in attendance. Everybody else was off domesticating or gestating in the country, and Mama and Papa had been visiting family in Scotland.
Mama sent an express, Charlotte said. She'll visit Elizabeth and me at Christmas.
I look forward to meeting her and your father.
No, Sherborne clearly did not, and Charlotte had her doubts that Mama would have visited at all, but for Elizabeth duchessing nearby in nothing less than a genuine crenellated castle.
Mama would lecture your ear off in Welsh, Charlotte said. I love to hear her speak in her native tongue, love the music of her scolds. Papa barely gets along in Welsh, but he insisted his offspring be proficient.
My servants all speak English and Welsh both. You may address them as you please.
Our servants. Sherborne was warm and solid, and a good deal more pleasant to lean against than the coach squabs. But what to talk about? What to talk about for the next half century?
Would you like to have friends pay us a visit, Charlotte?
No, thank you. I'm sure we'll have a steady parade of family over the years. They'll want to look in on us, and Elizabeth is right next door. Mama loves her homeland, and travelling here by sea isn't that difficult for those closer to the coast.
The coach hit a spectacular pothole, tossing Charlotte nearly into her husband's lap.
I assure you Sherborne Hall is appointed as elegantly as any Mayfair mansion, he said. You needn't worry that your friends will pity you for your domicile.
Charlotte unlooped his arm from her shoulders.
Your home was once a ducal dower house, from what I understand. Of course it will be commodious.
In his way, Sherborne was trying. Charlotte's conscience compelled her to extend an olive branch.
The fact is, I can think of nobody to invite.
The dratted coach chose then to sway around a curve, all but shoving Charlotte against her husband.
Not a single soul, Sherborne asked. No friends from finishing school? Ladies who made their come-out with you, former governesses, that sort of thing?
Charlotte had wondered similarly about her husband. Who were his friends?
Most of the women I made my come-out with have long since married and started families. Finishing school was years ago, and I have a wealth of sisters and cousins. One young lady who was like a sister to me has gone to her reward.
Saying the words hurt. Charlotte thought often of Fern Porter, but she almost never spoke of her.
A good friend? Sherborne asked.
Outside, the rain pounded down, and the countryside went by in a dreary brown blur. Autumn was more advanced here, not a benevolent easing of summer's heat, but a harbinger of winter's dark and cold.
She was a best friend, Charlotte said softly. Fern and I were inseparable from the first day we met at the age of 11. We shared a room at school. We shared hopes and fears, and got into such mischief. When we had to separate over holidays, we'd write to each other daily. I had hoped she'd marry one of my cousins, though she was a mere minister's daughter.
Sherborne's arm had found its way around Charlotte's shoulders again. Maybe husbands and wives travelled like this, all snuggled up and informal, despite the potholes.
Fern became enamoured of a handsome bounder after we finished school, Charlotte went on. She couldn't afford London seasons, but her family scraped together some means, and we sewed her dresses ourselves. When she came to town, she went everywhere with me. Then I realized
she'd stopped joining me on many of our outings.
She was smitten.
Sherborne's tone was indulgent, the mature male making a tolerant allowance for the follies of young women. Charlotte could leave him to his ignorance, but Fern's memory deserved honesty. She was smitten. Then she was ruined. Then she was dead. Sherborne took Charlotte's hand.
I'm sorry. I hope she did not take her own life.
This was the hardest part. The part that still had the power to make Charlotte's throat ache. She had a child, a little boy. She wrote to me, said she was happy despite all, because she loved that child more than life. She did not recover from her lying in. The child's father, a lord's son, never acknowledged her letters, never so much as apologized for her ruin. Charlotte braced herself for a platitude, which she would somehow manage to endure without tossing Sherborne from the coach. These things happen, a cautionary tale. Where was the girl's family when she was going so badly astray? Such a pity. And then the one she dreaded most. You were her friend. Why couldn't you talk sense into her? Why did nobody ever talk sense into the man who caused such tragedies? Why wasn't he at least deprived of the ability to wreck another young woman's life and leave another child to be raised in poverty and disgrace?
Who was the father?
Sherborne asked. I don't know. I have a likeness of him that Fern sent me to save for the child, lest her family destroy it. But I have no idea of his name. He frequented Mayfair ballrooms, so he had means as well as family connections. He also had a fiancée with fat settlements, though he didn't bother to tell Fern that until it was too late. If I ever find out who he is, I won't answer for the consequences. Sherborne propped a boot on the opposite bench.
If you do find out, I might be able to ruin him. I'm part owner of a bank that holds many mortgages for the Mayfair set, and I have some influence in Parliament. If his family is titled, so much the better. We can make an example of him, and ensure all and sundry know why his debts are being called in.
Charlotte ought to scold her husband for putting his boot on the opposite bench, but she was too stunned by his response. You would take the part of my late friend against a lord's son. Sherborne kissed her knuckles.
With pleasure. What foolish young people get up to when chaperones are lax is not my business, but there's a child involved. If it were your child, the father would have been held responsible and probably forced to marry you, regardless of a fiancé or breach of promise suit. The mother was relatively poor, and thus the bounder suffered no consequences. He probably knew that as he was charming his way under her skirts.
Thank you, Charlotte said, subsiding against him. Sherborne's motivations were his own. He was apparently critical of a class system based on arbitrary ancestry rather than merit, but he shared Charlotte's sense of outrage. If some fine day she found out who had destroyed Fern's good name, Sherborne would make a thorough job of that man's downfall. A lovely wedding present, did Sherborne but know it. The loveliest. Chapter 7
Leave the ladies alone, Haverford said. They have much to discuss, and you owe me a drink.
His Grace had been Sherborne's neighbour since birth. Their parents and grandparents had been at outs, and thus he and Haverford had been raised to nod curtly at each other in the churchyard, and then only if the vicar was watching.
Did I, or did I not recently enter into the state of holy matrimony?
Sherborne countered.
As such, does it not fall to you to offer me a drink, Your Grace?
Sherborne felt entitled to grouse, for Haverford and his duchess had deprived the new bride of the honour of being carried over the threshold by her husband. As soon as the horses had halted, the duchess had flown down the steps of Sherborne Hall and enveloped Sherborne in a hug, while Haverford had stood smirking on the terrace. Then Her Grace had swept Charlotte into an equally indecorous embrace, and bustled her into the house. The senior staff had been lined up in the foyer, ready to greet their new lady, and Sherborne had been relegated to making introductions.